once again, and thanks for joining us for Time Magazine. I'm Randall Rickman of North Carolina Reading Service, and I'll be reading to you from this edition of Time Magazine, which is dated December 16th, 2019. And welcome back. You've been listening to North Carolina Reading Service, and this program's content is intended for those who are blind and print impaired. We'll start this edition by going right to the rear of the magazine so we can include the feature of interviews. This edition is called Seven Questions. The interview subject is Greta Gerwig. Time says the Oscar-nominated filmmaker on her adaptation of Little Women, a banner year for female directors, and directing while secretly pregnant. Interview is conducted by Eliza Berman. First question. Do you remember when you first encountered Louisa May Alcott's Little Women? Answer. It must have been read to me because I don't remember a time when I didn't know who Jo March was. I don't know if I wanted to be a writer, which is why I liked Jo March, or Jo March was a writer, so I wanted to be a writer too. But I did the thing you can only do with books as a child, where your own autobiography and the contents of a book merge. Question. It's been adapted many times. What made you want to adapt it now? Answer. I reread the book as an adult, and I was bowled over by how modern it was, how much it was about women, ambition, art, and money. There were lines that could have been written yesterday. It was a chance to address things that were so personal and also to do something radical with it. I think you have license with material that is beloved because you can start with a common language. Question. Speaking of modern, there's a scene in the movie when Laura Dern's Marmy says, "I'm angry nearly every day of my life." It sounds like a nod to female rage in 2019, but that was in the book? Answer. I am having them say the dialogue with such controlled chaos and choreographed cacophony that it comes across as having just been written by me, when in fact every word is either from the book or Alcott's journals, letters, or another book she's written. If you strip away this pre-Victorian morality, what you have is ambitious, passionate, angry, sexual, interesting women who don't fit into the boxes the world has given them. Question. Did Alcott have amazing foresight? Answer. I think she was one of the people the future spoke through. I don't think she necessarily knew what she was accomplishing by telling the lives of girls and women as if they were important, because they are important. I think narratively, we are still figuring out how to tell stories about women that involve more than marriage or death. Question. When you became the fifth woman nominated for an Oscar for Best Director for Lady Bird in 2018, you were held up as an example of how far women behind the camera have come and still have to go. What was that like? Answer. I live really close to the New School and New York University, and these younger women come up to me and say, "I saw your film, and I want to make my own films." Being recognized by my peers in the academy, and then having that translate to young women directly, it's the reason I do it. Question. There are many great films by women in contention this award season, and they tend to be discussed as a group. Is that helpful or harmful? Answer. It's a banner year, and we should feel good about that and try to repeat it. It feels that there is both a sisterhood, which is wonderful because nobody wants to be at the dance party on their own, and also that their films are being put alongside great male filmmakers without an asterisk. I'm happy for it to be special and not special at the same time. Final question. You filmed Little Women while secretly pregnant. Some people are amazed when they hear of a woman accomplishing something great while pregnant. Others say it treats it as a condition to be overcome. What do you think? Answer. I feel very lucky that I was able to direct this movie while pregnant. I don't want anything to be used as another way that women can feel bad. I'm amazed at women who have kids, who don't have kids, who keep working, who step back. We are just figuring out how to have this conversation for directors, for doctors, for all kinds of women. We're just at the beginning of it. That was the entire Time interview conducted by Eliza Berman with Greta Gerwig, Oscar-nominated filmmaker, director of Little Women. Now we go to the front of the book, and that takes us to the For the Record page, a one-page collection of tiny news items, each one illustrated by a two-color drawing, a caption or headline in bold, or a combination of the two. In the upper right corner of the page is a story illustrated by the numerical statistic in bright red, 14,315. Caption explains, number of Thanksgiving Day inquiries to the Butterball Turkey Talk Line, which provides answers to turkey-related cooking questions. 14,315. And the middle right margin of the page is a story illustrated by a quotation from Virginia Jeffrey. Jeffrey Epstein accuser in a BBC interview about her allegations that Britain's Prince Andrew had sex with her when she was 17. And the quotation from Virginia Jeffrey, Jeffrey Epstein accuser, quote, I just didn't expect it from royalty, unquote. Time goes on to say, he, Prince Andrew, denies the claims. Running along the bottom of the page is a story illustrated by a quotation from Facebook. A notice on a post from a blog critical of the government. Singapore invoked a controversial, quote, fake news, unquote, law to get the social network to add the note. And the note, quoted from Facebook, quote, Facebook is legally required to tell you that the Singapore government says this post has false information, unquote. Above that is a story illustrated by a quotation from Lisa Page, former FBI lawyer, in a December 1 tweet after she spoke to the Daily Beast. The quotation from former FBI lawyer Lisa Page, in all caps and bold black, quote, I'm done being quiet, unquote. Capture goes on to say, she became a target of President Trump's ire after her August 2016 text messages about him became public. In the lower left corner of the page is a story illustrated by the monetary amount in bright red, $9.4 billion. Caption explains, amount Americans spent online on Cyber Monday, December 2nd, a record for the retail holiday, $9.4 billion on Cyber Monday. Above that in the left margin of the page is a story illustrated by, again in bright red, the numerical chronological statistic 18,000. Caption explains, age in years of a prehistoric puppy found frozen in permafrost in Russia. 18,000 years. In the upper left corner of the page is a story illustrated by a quotation from Donald Trump, U.S. president. On December 4th, at a NATO summit, after Canadian Prime Minister Justin Trudeau was caught on a hot microphone, apparently complaining about Trump with other world leaders. Now, the quotation from U.S. President Donald Trump, in all black, quote, "He's two-faced," unquote. In the right center of the page is another edition of the feature in a feature, Bad Week, Good Week. At Bad Week, Spuds. A weak potato harvest brought fears of a possible French fry shortage. Under Good Week, Suds. An experiment bound for the ISS, International Space Station, could bring Budweiser closer to brewing beer in space. In the center of the page is a story illustrated by a quotation from Nancy Pelosi, Speaker of the House, pledging at UN climate talks in Madrid on December 2nd to continue fighting climate change despite the Trump administration's plan to withdraw from the Paris Agreement. The quotation from Nancy Pelosi, Speaker of the House, quote, "We are still in. The United States is still in," unquote. That was the entire contents of For the Record. That now brings us to the major leading section called The Brief. And in that section, the first subsection is Opener, which leads us to Foreign Policy, where the headline is A Mixed Message on Afghan Peace, by Kimberly Dozier. President Donald Trump had barely been in Afghanistan for a few hours on November 28th when he made three bold declarations. In coming days, Trump said, the Taliban would stop their attacks and stalled peace talks would resume. But he also told Afghan officials the U.S. would keep a small number of troops there indefinitely. Quote, "They didn't want to do a ceasefire, but now they do want to do a ceasefire," unquote, Trump said of the Taliban during a press conference at Bagram Airfield, north of Kabul, roughly 13 hours after flying from Maryland under the cover of darkness for a surprise Thanksgiving visit to the troops. Quote, "It will probably work out that way," unquote. Any compromise must come from Trump, since it was he who canceled a planned peace summit at Camp David via Twitter on September 7th. So it's hard to say who Trump was trying to reach with these new messages. This mess now falls to U.S. peace envoy Ambassador Zalmay Khalilzad to clean up. Khalilzad, who was in Kabul on December 4th, must try to talk the Taliban and a reducing attacks on U.S. and Afghan forces without calling it a ceasefire, while convincing Trump and the Afghan government that he's achieved a ceasefire in all but name. Those are excerpts from this lengthy article. It is an entire page, and we are moving on to include more material. We will include this metric, a series of three metrics included in the article, in the middle of the page. There are three metrics in red. First metric, 18. Caption explains number of years U.S. troops have been in Afghanistan. 18. Next statistic, 3,804. Caption says number of Afghan civilian war-related deaths in 2018, 3,804. Final statistic, 2,440. Caption explains number of U.S. military deaths in Afghanistan since 2001. The number again, 2,440. Moving ahead, and that brings us to That brings us to the bulletin section, where the headline is, amid fallout from journalist's death, Malta's prime minister will step down. Article by Rachel Bunyan. When Malta's prime minister, Joseph Muscat, announced December 1st that he would step down, the news was both sudden and a long time coming. His decision was prompted by new arrests and the 2017 murder of Daphne Caruana Galizia, a Maltese journalist who had investigated corruption at the highest levels of the country's government. More than 2 years have passed since a bomb detonated under the driver's seat in her rental car. But even after Muscat's decision, the political crisis that was triggered by her death continues. We're moving on. Before we leave this page, there is a photograph. Normally we don't talk about photographs, but this is compelling, and the caption will explain the contents of the photograph. Leanne O'Brien, center, took part in a ceremony in Cambridge, England, on December 2nd, to honor her boyfriend, Jack Merritt, 25, and Sasha Jones, 23, who were killed on November 29th in a terrorist attack near London Bridge. The Cambridge graduates were stabbed by Usman Khan, 28, who had been previously convicted of a terrorist plot in 2012. Khan, who wore a fake suicide vest, was tackled by bystanders who wielded a narwhal tusk and a fire extinguisher before he was shot dead by police. So this photograph is a young man and woman comforting person in the middle, who is Leanne O'Brien, and her eyes are closed. On the right margin of this page is the sidebar feature news ticker. Three news items stacked one on top of the other. Top item, Harris ends presidential campaign. California Senator Kamala Harris suspended her run for the White House on December 3rd. The Democrats surged after the July debate, but struggled to maintain her position in the polls and with donors. The week also saw the end of lower-profile bids from former Pennsylvania Congressman Joe Sestak and Montana Governor Steve Bullock. Middle item, Putin signs foreign agent law. Russian President Vladimir Putin approved a bill December 2nd that will allow Russia to declare journalists and bloggers foreign agents if they distribute content and receive funding from abroad. Journalists and human rights activists say the law is, quote, meant to allow the Kremlin to silence its critics. That was not a quote, by the way. That was from Time's caption. List bottom item. Georgia Senate pick rankles Trump allies. Georgia Governor Brian Kemp on December 4th named businesswoman Kelly Loeffler to replace U.S. Senator Johnny Isaacson, who was set to retire at the end of 2019. The pick ran counter to President Trump's wish to have Representative Douglas A. Collins fill the seat. That was news ticker. Moving forward, we are now at the milestones page under Died, William Ruckelshaus, Saturday Night Massacre, Resister. Observance by John Dean. Time says Dean, who was White House counsel during Watergate is now a CNN commentator. He writes, I met William Ruckelshaus, who died on November 27th at 87, at the Department of Justice in 1969 when he ran the Civil Division, and I was Associate Deputy Attorney General. Ruckelshaus came late to Watergate. He'd been the first administrator of the Environmental Protection Agency, starting in 1970, before he took over the FBI in April 1973. President Nixon thought Ruckelshaus looked like an FBI director because he was kind of jowly. I didn't have regular dealings with him, but one of the more interesting conversations we had over the years was about the Saturday Night Massacre, the firing of Special Prosecutor Archibald Cox on October 20th, 1973. Nixon told Attorney General Elliot Richardson to fire Cox. Richardson wouldn't do it and resigned. White House Chief of Staff Al Haig called the Deputy Attorney General, which was Ruckelshaus's job by then. Ruckelshaus wouldn't fire Cox either. Solicitor General Robert Bork, the third in line, did. Later, Ruckelshaus told me he and Richardson had pleaded with Bork to do it, because if he resigned too, there was no clear next step. They worried about chaos. Who would sign orders? Ruckelshaus also said that Cox, his former law school professor, told him, quote, you did just what I expected you to do, unquote. I think everyone who knew Ruckelshaus's thought he was honest, fair, an individual who would do the right thing in virtually any situation. John Dean on William Ruckelshaus. This item is accompanied by a full-color, half-length photograph. The caption says, Ruckelshaus, who resigned rather than carry out President Nixon's orders, testifies before a U.S. Senate committee in 1973. He's wearing a dark suit, dark striped tie, and white shirt, and horn-rim glasses. Under died Irving Berge, Calypso King. Observance by Andrew R. Chow. When calypso music exploded out of the Caribbean in the 1950s, its unexpected success among mainland audiences was in large part thanks to musician and folklorist Irving Louis Berge. Berge, who died November 29th at 95 and was known professionally as Lord Burgess, is best known for his collaborations with Harry Belafonte, with whom he shared a New York City birthplace and Caribbean heritage. Belafonte was connected to Berge by a friend who called him, quote, the Black Alan Lomax, a walking library of songs from the islands, unquote, and the pair quickly hit it off. Berge was a writer on most of the songs on Belafonte's 1956 Calypso, which became the first album to sell a million copies in the U.S. The album's most enduring song was Banana Boat Song, Deo, which Berge, with William Attaway, adapted from a Jamaican folk tune. The song was emblematic of his approach, melding irresistible melodies with fresh lyrics that reflected working-class island life. And paying homage to his heritage, Berge forged a song that would be covered countless times, not just in the Caribbean, but around the world. Observance by Andrew R. Chow, Irving Berge, Calypso King. This is accompanied by a half-length, full-color photograph. Caption says, Berge, seen here in 2012, also wrote the lyrics to Barbados's national anthem. Under argued that grand jury documents from the Mueller investigation should not be released to House lawmakers in a brief filed on December 2nd by the Justice Department. under arrived. Teen climate activist Greta Thunberg in Portugal on December 3rd after crossing the Atlantic by boat. She's set to attend the UN's climate summit in Madrid. Underreported that reading and math performance among U.S. teens has not improved significantly since 2000, per the results of the Program for International Student Assessment, released December 3rd. Undersubmitted, amicus briefs against the Louisiana abortion restriction headed to the Supreme Court. Submitted by medical groups, including the American Medical Association and the American College of Obstetricians and Gynecologists. Underhospitalized, former President Jimmy Carter, 95, with an infection. Carter, who was released December 4th, also had brain surgery just last month. Underintroduced, a law that would cap foreign political donations in New Zealand at $33 on December 3rd. Underannounced, Google founders Sergey Brin and Larry Page on December 3rd that they're leaving their respective roles as president and CEO of its parent company, Alphabet. That's the entire content of the milestones page. Still in the brief, we're looking at the news page, which contains Good Question, a recurring feature, where the headline is, Why are remains from Pearl Harbor still being identified? By Tara Law. When the remains of U.S. Navy sailor Victor Patrick Tomlinson are buried on December 7th in his hometown of Raymondsville, Texas, 78 years will have passed since he was killed in the Japanese attack on Pearl Harbor. Tomlinson, just 19, and 428 others perished aboard the battleship USS Oklahoma when it was sunk in the surprise attack, which killed 2,403 American personnel, sank or damaged 21 ships, and resulted in the U.S. entry into World War II. And of the people killed at Pearl Harbor, the remains of more than 1,300 are still classified as unidentified. Now, the Department of Defense, armed with new technology and a record of success identifying those killed in more recent conflicts, is making a concerted effort to sift through some of the remains, starting with those recovered from the Oklahoma. A previous attempt in the 1940s to identify service members who were recovered from the wreckage ultimately failed because many remains had been mixed together and researchers were limited to the forensic methods of the era, like dental records. The remains were buried as unknowns in the National Memorial Cemetery of the Pacific in Hawaii by 1950. The USS Oklahoma was playing an important role in sparking new hope for the lost service members can be identified and given proper burial. But it's a painstaking process. When the military exhumed a coffin of remains from the ship's wreckage in 2003, researchers found traces of about 100 people. Investigators are using several tools in their work, including collecting mitochondrial DNA samples from the families of lost service members and matching them to samples from the remains. In the past 4 years alone, the Department of Defense has identified about 200 people from the Oklahoma, and that's just one ship. Timothy McMahon, the director of Department of Defense DNA Operations, says that the success of the Oklahoma project gave the military more confidence that the latest identification technology was accurate enough to justify digging up the commingled remains of other service members. And so, Tomlinson is returning home nearly 8 decades after his death. His family says the burial will help to bring closure, even after all these years. Although his sacrifice was honored in Raymondville at the local Veterans of Foreign Wars post and marked with a headstone in the cemetery, his mother struggled with not having been able to bury him, says his niece, Kathy Ayers. Quote, "Until the day she died, she said, 'I wish they could bring my boy home,'" unquote, Ayers says. On December 7th, his remains will be accompanied by an honor guard detail and laid to rest beside his mother. Several dozen family members from across the country plan to attend. Quote, "At the end of the day," unquote, says Tomlinson's nephew, James Patrick Tomlinson, quote, "that's where he belongs," unquote. Story by Tara Law. The left margin of this page is another version of news ticker. Again, three news items stacked one on top of the other. Top item, Iran shakes fist over nuclear deal. The UN's Atomic Watchdog Group has accused Iran of a number of violations of the 2015 nuclear deal. But Tehran warned December 1st that it might, quote, "seriously reconsider," unquote, its commitments to the group if the European parties to the deal activated a dispute mechanism that could lead to sanctions. Middle item. Supreme Court hears gun case. The Supreme Court sat for arguments December 2nd in a suit over a New York City restriction on transporting guns, the court's first Second Amendment case in nearly 10 years. After the Supreme Court granted the review, legislators mooted the restriction, leading to debate over whether the court should issue a ruling at all. Final item, protests in India after vet's murder. Protests flared across India on December 1 after the alleged gang rape and murder of a 27-year-old veterinarian, whose charred body was found November 28th near Hyderabad. 4 men have been arrested. Demonstrators demanded new laws to protect women from widespread violence. Running along the bottom of the page, under the general heading Freight, the headline is Delivery Disasters. A hazmat team responded to a Washington State movie theater after it received a package labeled, quote, "highly contagious human substance," unquote, which turned out to be urine intended for a medical clinic. Here, other shipping snafus collected by Alejandro de la Garza, who lists 3 examples running along the bottom of the page, left to right. First example, on the left, smuggling slip. In May, an Australian couple was mistakenly delivered a package containing $7 million worth of methamphetamine. They called the police, who were able to use that lead to make an arrest in the case. Middle item, Amazon arrest. A Massachusetts man who ordered a TV on Amazon was arrested in March for allegedly keeping a second TV that was wrongly delivered to his address. He claimed Amazon told him he had, quote, "nothing to worry about," unquote. Final item on the right, missile mistake. In 2007, 6 nuclear-tipped cruise missiles were accidentally transported from North Dakota to Louisiana on a B-52 bomber. 4 U.S. Air Force officers were fired in the wake of the incident. Moving ahead, and that brings us, still in the nation, to this headline, fear of mass shootings fuels a thriving bulletproof business. by Melissa Chan. Lori Aladef is haunted by the fact that she did not send her 14-year-old daughter to school with a bulletproof backpack. The mother of three had wanted to buy one, but never got around to it. By February 14, 2018, it was too late. Her first child, Alisa, was fatally shot trying to hide under a classroom table at Marjorie Stoneman Douglas High School in Parkland, Florida. Marjorie Stoneman Douglas High School, where 16 others were killed. Quote, "I wish to this day that I did give that protection to Alisa. It could have saved her life," unquote, Aladef says. Quote, "Obviously, I regret that," unquote. After the massacre, Aladef bought bulletproof backpacks for her two sons, who are now 15 and 12. Quote, "I have peace in my heart for my two boys, at least, that I'm doing everything in my power to protect them," unquote, says Aladef, who won't let her sons go to school without the backpacks. With dozens of people killed so far in mass shootings in the U.S. in 2019, through an influx of products marketed to those scared of being shot or of loved ones to gun violence, thousands of Americans are seeking security. Backpacks that double as shields are sold by major department stores, including Home Depot and Bed Bath & Beyond. There are bulletproof hoodies for children, protective whiteboards and windows, armored doors and anchors to keep shooters out of classrooms, and smart cameras powered by artificial intelligence that alert authorities to threats. In Fruitport, Michigan, officials are building a $48 million high school specially designed to deter shooters, with curved walls to reduce the lines of sight, bulletproof windows, and a special locking system. In 2017, U.S. schools spent at least $2.7 billion in security systems, on top of the money spent by individuals on things like bulletproof backpacks, the IHS market consulting firm reported. In 2014, the figure was about $768 million. IHS said there's no known case of bullet-resistant items saving students from a shooting. None of the industry leaders who spoke with Time could cite a case. And critics of the industry say the only beneficiaries of these so-called security measures are the people making money off them. In fact, most of the bulletproof items, including backpacks and hoodies, would protect against handguns, but not against the assault-style weapons often used in high-casualty attacks. Assault-style weapons were used in the Parkland shooting and in the Sandy Hook Elementary School attack on December 2012. Quote, "These companies are capitalizing on parents' fears," unquote, says Shannon Watts, a mother of five, who founded the gun control advocacy group Moms Demand Action following the Sandy Hook shooting, which killed 20 first graders and six educated. In September, as students were returning to school, Sandy Hook Promise, a gun violence prevention nonprofit led by family members of Sandy Hook victims, released a video that used biting satire to highlight the country's failure to prevent mass shootings. It showed cheerful children returning for classes and using their new clothes and school supplies to survive a shooting. One boy uses his skateboard to smash a window and escape. A girl uses her new socks to tie a tourniquet. The message is clear. These shootings should be prevented before kids get to the point of using tube socks to save classmates from bleeding to death. But with efforts at gun control legislation stalled, as the Senate refuses to take up a House-passed bill that would require background checks for private gun sales, even critics of the booming security industry concede it's unlikely to slow down. Quote, there's not a parent in the country who isn't worried that their child will be the next victim of gun violence, unquote, Watts says. There is more to this article by Melissa Chan. We are moving ahead to make sure we include a wide variety of content. That brings us to the next big section, The View. And its subsection, World, has the headline, The Disunited Kingdom, by Fintan O'Toole. In July, Prime Minister Boris Johnson gave himself an additional title no predecessor had assumed, Minister for the Union. The union in question is not the European one, which Johnson is determined to leave. It is simply his own country, the United Kingdom of Great Britain and Northern Ireland. The title betrays a deep anxiety. For in breaking one union with Europe, Brexit is endangering another, the centuries-old union of England with Wales, Scotland, and part of Ireland. Assuming, as the polls predict, that Johnson's Conservative Party wins the UK general election on December 12th, he will have to grapple with that contradiction. 5 years ago, it was clear where the danger to the Union was coming from, mainly Scottish and Irish nationalism. Although Scotland voted to remain part of the UK in its 2014 plebiscite, the 45% who backed independence made it clear that the cause was now a mainstream proposition. And then there was, as always, the Irish question. The 1998 peace deal that brought an end to the long civil conflict known as the Troubles acknowledged that the six northeastern counties that make up Northern Ireland can leave the UK whenever a majority of its population wishes to do so. But the most pressing threat to the Union turned out to be not on the fringes, but right at the center, a simmering crisis of national identity in England. That became obvious in the Brexit referendum of 2016. Support for leaving the EU was primarily an English phenomenon. Though Wales did vote narrowly for Brexit, Scotland and Northern Ireland voted heavily against it. It was the rich southeast of England and the old working class of the Midlands and North that drove Leave, that's capitalized, to victory. The rebirth of Englishness as a political force. The shift was 20 years in the making, a reaction to two big events at the end of the 20th century. One was the Belfast Agreement of 1998, which made Northern Ireland's membership in the UK an open question. The other was the establishment of the Scottish Parliament in 1999, giving Scots considerable powers over their own affairs. In hindsight, it was perhaps inevitable that many in England would start to ask the awkward question, what about us? Why did they not ask that question before? Englishness, after all, is a very old political identity. The truth is that for most south of Hadrian's Wall and east of Offa's Dyke, England and Britain were synonyms. To them, the UK was England with a few funny bits attached. They did not have to consider how England fits into the larger multinational structure of the UK, because they could take it for granted that they dominated it. This complacency was a mark of the extraordinary success of the Union. It is not a natural entity, but constructed piecemeal over a very long time. I'll repeat that sentence for clarity. It is not a natural entity, but constructed piecemeal over a very long time. Wales, a country with its own language, traditions, and institutions, was incorporated into the English realm in 1536. The United Kingdom of Great Britain was established in 1707 when Scotland joined England and Wales. Ireland was added in 1801, but most of it left in 1922. Given this rather rickety construction, the big question is perhaps not why the Union is troubled, but why it has held together so long. The UK worked mostly because of four great binding forces: religion, the Industrial Revolution, empire, and war. The idea of the UK as a haven of Protestantism on a continent dominated by hostile Catholic powers was powerfully unifying. The Industrial Revolution created a common way of life in its cities and towns. Empire allowed the Irish, Welsh, and Scots to share its spoils and the prestige it conferred. And war bound people together as comrades. But each of these four forces is now essentially gone. Britain is outstandingly irreligious. Little more than one-third of the population are Protestant, and half say they have no religion at all. It is no longer an industrial economy. 81% of its output is based on services, not goods. The empire is gone, and the bitter divisions over the Iraq War in 2003 shattered the belief that military triumphs bind the four nations together. What could replace these crumbling pillars of the Union? One strategy was to try to appease the minority nationalists by giving the Celtic nations their own parliaments. This worked up to a point, but especially in Scotland, the existence of a devolved parliament has actually led to a distinctive political culture. The other big idea was to rebrand the Union as Cool Britannia, an open, vibrant, multicultural and multinational state. But Brexit has finally undermined that idea. Britain does not look especially open or cool right now. Is this the end of the UK? Is the end of the UK inevitable? Not in the short term. While Brexit makes Scottish independence more likely, it also makes it much more difficult if Scotland were in the EU. The hard border with England post-Brexit would be immensely problematic. And Ireland is nowhere near being ready to be united. The divisions that flared in the Troubles have still to be resolved. But what no one really imagined is that the future of the Union may not be in Scotland's or Ireland's hands. It is England, once the steady old spouse, that is increasingly angling for a divorce. While it is the business of making an exit from one union, it may talk itself into leaving another. Entire article by Fenton O'Toole. Times says O'Toole is a columnist with the Irish Times and author of The Politics of Pain, Postwar England and the Rise of Nationalism. O'Toole. First name Fenton, spelled F-I-N-T-A-N, Fenton O'Toole. We're now moving ahead. This article is entitled Man in the Middle. Ukraine's Vladimir Zelensky is caught between a crumbling U.S. alliance and a hostile Russia. Article by Simon Schuster, Dateline, Kiev. Schuster writes, "A year is a long time in politics, long enough in the case of Vladimir Zelensky, the comedian elected president of Ukraine, to go from the set of his sitcom in Kiev to the biggest political drama in the world, the one in which an American president may wind up getting impeached. The Democrats have cast Zelensky as the victim of President Donald Trump's abuse of power, even as Republicans treat him as the witness key to proving Trump's innocence. Neither role is anywhere close to what Zelensky imagined for himself when he announced his run for the presidency on New Year's Eve, although he knew the job would be tough if he won, and often very unpleasant. Ukraine has been at war with Russia for the past 5 years, and its priority as president would be to stop that war from taking any more lives, a toll that is now more than 13,000 and counting. That task would mean confronting Vladimir Putin, the Russian president who first ordered his troops into Ukraine in 2014. But Zelensky also wondered early on about Trump and the challenges of working with him. Quote, "What's he like," unquote, he asked me, "of working with him," when we first met in March backstage at his comedy show, which he was using to promote his run for Ukraine's highest office. Quote, "Normal guy," unquote. Wedged between the mirror and the costume rack inside his dressing room, the 41-year-old seemed confident, even cocky, and planning to win Trump over with little more than a wisecrack and a smile. Quote, "We'll figure it out," unquote, he told me. Quote, "I'm sure we'll get along," unquote. Things have turned out rather differently. At the point in its history when Ukraine needs American support the most, Trump has gone out of his way to paint the nation as corrupt, unreliable, and opposed to his administration. Russia has rejoiced at these characterizations, and Ukraine's key allies in Europe have put on a mask of cool neutrality, voicing support for Zelensky while also seeking deals with Putin. There's much more to this article, but we move on because there's another big article we'd like to include, the headline of which is "The Way We Fight Back" by Brian Bennett, Dateline Sunrise, Florida, also written in conjunction with Chris Wilson. Their lead paragraph says, "Trump's campaign has turned impeachment into a fundraising asset with ads on Facebook, Instagram, and other social media platforms." On stage in the packed Thunderous Hockey Arena in Sunrise, Florida, President Donald Trump's campaign manager, Brad Parscale, urges the crowd to pull out their cell phones and text themselves onto the campaign's contact list. Their phones are key to helping Trump get reelected in the face of his likely impeachment by the House. Quote, "The way we fight back," unquote, Parscale booms, quote, "is to get online ourselves and get connected, sign up for emails," unquote. A slapshot away from Parscale, voter Alan Huber doesn't need to sign up. He is already connected and gets Trump campaign messages, most often by scrolling through Facebook. Quote, "I don't have to watch Fox or CNN or read Time magazine or anything else. I'll get anything important from my Facebook feed," unquote, says Huber, who's in his 60s and drove down the Florida coast from Boynton Beach on November 26th to see Trump in person. Quote, "I think that the media doesn't fully appreciate the power of the Facebook feed," unquote. The Trump campaign does. In the weeks since House Speaker Nancy Pelosi's September 24th decision to launch an impeachment inquiry against Trump for using the power of his presidency to press a foreign country, Ukraine, to investigate a political rival, the Trump campaign hasn't run from Pelosi's impeachment push or settled into a defensive crouch. Campaign officials instead are leaning into the impeachment threat, using it to mobilize supporters and try to extract a political price and millions of dollars in fundraising from the Democrats' move. One of the single most powerful weapons in the Trump campaign's arsenal has been Facebook, which, unlike many TV stations and newspapers, does not monitor candidates' political ads for veracity. A time analysis of publicly available Facebook data, which included the cataloging of hundreds of distinct messages, shows how Trump is using social media to supercharge his pushbacks against impeachment and add to his considerable $150 million war chest. Ads that many Americans would otherwise never see have been tested and tailored to solicit responses from older voters, deploying Trump's distinctive use of capital letters and words like scam and witch hunt. That brings us to the end of our time for today's time. We hope you've gained something from our reading, and we thank you for your patience with your reader today. My name again, Randall Rickman of North Carolina Reading Service. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. This broadcast is readily available as a podcast at our website, ncreadingservice.org. Once again, that's ncreadingservice.org. If you have any comments or questions, please call us at 919-832-5138. Once again, that is 919-832-5138. This is your loyal reader, Randall Rickman, thanking you once again for joining us. And we're waiting for you to join us next time for Time.